Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. You may not know the name Chuck Lavelle, but if you know much about rock and roll, you know this. That's the Allman Brothers song, Jessica. And that is Chuck Lavelle playing what a lot of people consider to be the greatest rock piano solo ever recorded. Lavelle was a member of the Allmans in the 70s, and since 1982, he's been the keyboard player and musical director for the Rolling Stones. Along the way, he's played with everyone from George Harrison and Eric Clapton to John Mayer and the Indigo Girls. And beyond his music career, he's built a second life as an environmentalist and the owner of a tree farm at his home in Georgia. Here's our conversation. Chuck Lavelle, you started playing professionally about when? Like how old?
Well, I would say my very first band, we played the YMCA in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and we did get paid $50 between four guys, so $12.50 each.
I think that counts.
That counts, baby. So I was 13.
Okay. And you're 66 now, if I got that right?
I am indeed.
Tell me now, what are the differences between being a rock and roll guy at 13 and being a rock and roll guy at 66?
Not much, really, that I can ascertain. You know, it's still a thrill for me every time I get to make music, either on my own or with others, and it was a thrill back then. So, I mean, you know, there's technical differences from the 60s to the 2018, I mean, but in terms of the feeling that I get and the reason that I do it, there's really not much difference.
So, I remember, I covered music for a while, and I remember getting invited backstage to a Grateful Dead show. This has been, you know, maybe 25 years ago. And I walked back there not knowing what I would see, you know, just having heard and sort of absorbed all these sort of, you know, legendary rock and roll stories throughout my life. And I get back there and people are just kind of hanging out. And there's a cooler over on the side. And I open the cooler, you know, expecting to find all manner of things in there. And it was mostly like yogurt and orange juice, you know, and stuff like that. And I wonder now, kind of with the Stones, who you've been on the road with for a long, long time, if I was to go backstage at a Rolling Stone show, kind of what would it be like back there?
That's interesting. Yogurt with the Grateful Dead? Wow.
I know. That's not what I was expecting.
Not at all. Well, backstage at our show, it depends on what dressing room you go in, you know. I share a dressing room with our bass player, Daryl Jones, who is a great friend and just a great guy. You know, minimalist stuff, no alcohol, really. We have some Diet Cokes and water and, you know, there's meals being served and, you know, for everyone. And they're usually very, very good. The catering is usually excellent. In Mick's room, you know, he's gonna have some humidifiers going to keep his voice in shape, and he'll do his vocal exercises. And you know, he doesn't want to eat. Hardly any of us really want to eat very much, you know, close to showtime. So we may have a meal 2 or 3 hours out. But it's, you know, it's pretty mundane, man. I mean, you know, we're there to make music and not to get drunk or do crazy things. You know, we're there to put on a show. So we're pretty well focused on the business at hand.
And I know you're sort of the right word, musical manager for them now. What does all that involve? Is that something that's involved mostly kind of beforehand and sort of making arrangements of the songs and that sort of thing? Or is that something where you're sort of leading the band on stage, or some of both? How does that work out?
Well, they have bestowed upon me the moniker of musical director.
Musical director, yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice title to have, I guess. But the fact is that has evolved over a long period of time. You have to understand I've been with these guys 36 years now.
Right.
But back in 1989, when the band had the Steel Wheels record, and we had not toured at that juncture for some 7 years, it gave us an opportunity for sort of a rebirth. And, you know, one comment I made to the guys, because the first tour I did in 1982, every show was the same. The set list was the same beginning to end, some 30-odd shows. And I said, man, what a body of work you have. You know, let's explore that. Let's go deep and be ready to swap songs in and out. Obviously, you can't do all the hundreds of songs that Mick and Keith have written or the band has covered. But we had a very long rehearsal period in 1989 to prepare for the Steel Wheels tour. We did go through a huge number of songs, and at that juncture, I began to take notes. I made chord charts of songs that, you know, I felt like I might have to refresh my memory if we go back and do it again. I made notes on whether there was horn parts, and if they were horns, what did they play, background vocals, et cetera, et cetera. Did we change the arrangement for any reason live than what the record is? And so over all these years, I've compiled these two rather huge notebooks, A to Z, of just about every song the band has tried. Not literally everything, but I would say 80% anyway. And, you know, so I have kind of become the go-to guy. You know, Chuck knows, is the solo come before or after the second chorus?
Yeah, right.
That kind of thing.
So you have a book that says, like, if you guys are playing, I don't know, Brown Sugar, you have a book that basically says, here's how we've done it in the past, here's, you know, any tweaks we may have made over the years, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's correct. And then the other side of it is that, and by the way, it doesn't really apply that much to the iconic songs.
Yeah.
We know we're going to do. We know how to play Satisfaction. We know how to play, you know, but the oddball songs that you haven't done in a while require some memory work. And when we're on stage, if we're doing one of those songs and any of the guys are not sure where we're at, they can glance at me and I'll give them hand signals or a nod of approval or disapproval, you know, depending on the situation.
Well, that's something I've always wondered about, you know, especially a band like the Stones where, I mean, it's obviously really loud in the audience and I assume pretty loud on stage. How do you guys communicate with one another? And if there's anything sort of, I don't know, a complicated message you have to get across, how do you do that?
Well, again, hand signals can be helpful from time to time. You know, if I make a rolling motion with my hand, that just means keep on doing what you're doing, you know. If I can wag it left and right, that means, hey, heads up, you know, something's not right. Those kinds of things, glances, just general looks on the faces are helpful. And, you know, giving some encouragement, that's what I feel is so important. You know, if they're questioning where we are in a song or is this going right or am I singing in tune or whatever it might be, I want them to feel confident. So I do my best to convey that to them. When things are going right, hey man, it's cool. Everything is rocking. Don't worry. Let's go.
You know, that's really interesting to me to hear that because obviously the Stones have been playing music for 50 years or more now, and it's interesting to hear that at a given moment on stage they might not be confident or might have some doubts about what they're doing.
Well, you know, in general, we are confident. That's the way it works. But again, if there's a particular song that maybe you haven't done in 20 shows and you're doing it that night and you're in the middle of it and you have a question in your mind about what comes next, I mean, you know, that can happen to any band. Look, I got to say this, and I say it only because it's true. The Rolling Stones have never sounded better than they sound right now. Everyone is, you know, they're up, the game face is on. Everybody's up to speed. Everybody is enjoying it, you know, and that's really the heart of the matter. You got to enjoy it. If if you're doing it by rote or just, you know, for the money or whatever it might be, then it's likely not to be that great. But if you're doing it because you love it and because, you know, you get that feedback from the audience that turns you on and then you can in turn turn them on, that's really what it's all about.
Yeah. So I want to go all the way back to the beginning. My understanding is that you started playing piano or started getting interested in the piano because your mom played. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. My mom was not a professional, not a teacher, but she played for family enjoyment. We had a little spinet piano in the house. I was the youngest of three children. My older brother and sister, considerably older than I, my brother 14 years my elder, my sister 5 years my elder, dad out working. So oftentimes it was just me and mom in the house. And I loved to listen to her play. I loved to watch her hands move up and down that keyboard. And she would get me up on that stool when I was very young, say 5, 6 years old. And I think as partly a form of babysitting, she would show me very simple things and say, for instance, well, Chuck, I've got to go do some housework. You just sit here and make something up, or you can try to learn a new song or try out this new chord that I just showed you and just fool around and have fun, you know. So that was how it started.
And were you the kind of kid who picked up that stuff really quickly? I mean, were you able to kind of play what she played, or was it work for you to figure it out?
Well, I think, first of all, it was fun. I was enjoying it. You know, I love the sound. I love the feeling of the keys up under my hands. I loved listening to music, whether it was music that we heard on the radio. And you have to understand that in the South, and especially at that time, what were the influences? Well, you had indigenous music like country music. You had rhythm and blues and soul music coming out of the South. You had gospel, both black and white gospel music on the radio on Sunday. And you had British invasion. And so you had the Beatles, the Stones, the Zombies, the Dave Clark Five, and all of those bands that were being played prominently on the radio. And so it was an absorption of all of this. And I loved it all. You know, there was hardly anything I heard that I didn't really like.
I remember reading that, I guess this was in Alabama, when you were a young boy, maybe a teenager, that you went to a Ray Charles concert that sort of changed your life.
Yes, sir. It did change my life. And here's the way it worked. So my sister had a date to go see Ray Charles at the Coliseum in Tuscaloosa at the university. And mom and dad had a previous engagement, so they didn't want to leave me home alone, and they suggested to my sister Judy, why don't you take Chuck along? And she very graciously agreed to do that. Now, I was already interested in music. I was playing music. I wasn't at any kind of professional level at the time, but I was very interested in it. And I had, well, we had in our home that fantastic record, Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music.
I Can't Stop Loving You. Yeah.
Yes, sir. So I went to the concert, and it was just like a life-changing event. I mean, I don't know what to say. You know, Ray, of course, was Ray, and that incredible voice, his playing. But it was not just Ray. It was Billy Preston on Hammond B3.
Oh, wow.
Fathead Newman on sax. You had the Ray Letts singing, and the band was just so tight and powerful. The dynamics were brilliant. And I left that concert saying to myself, well, you know, no need to go to medical school or try to be an attorney or anything else. If I could ever be in a band that could have that effect on people, that's what I want to do.
Now, do you have, this would have been what, like 65, somewhere around in there?
Yeah, somewhere in there, maybe a little later, 66, no later than 67, probably around 66.
Do you have any memory of whether that was a segregated audience?
Well, I don't, to be honest with you. I'm sure there was, you know, 95% whites at that show. There might have been some blacks, but you're right, you know, those were in the segregation years. And, of course, you had George Wallace standing at the doorway to prevent black students from registering and going to class. And they were tough times. They were very tough times.
Yeah. Did you have any sort of memories of things like that that just happened sort of around where you were, anything like that?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, in the first band that I was in, we had this guitar player who shall remain nameless. Really nice guy. Very great guy. Not the best guitar player in the world, okay, but he was a sweet kid. He was a sweet kid. Well, we're reading the paper one day, and there's a KKK rally going through Tuscaloosa in the streets. And it turns out that his dad was one of those. And it totally freaked me out. It freaked out, you know, others in the band that had no idea. And that was an experience that shook us, you know, shook me for sure. And yes, you know, we heard and experienced all of what you can imagine segregation was like. And as a matter of fact, you know, one of the first bands professionally that I played with was a black group from Stillman College in Tuscaloosa, and they were called the Jades, and they were like a Temptations or Four Tops. You know, they danced and sang and beautiful harmonies, and they had this keyboard player named Freddie, and Freddie was kind of relegated back to the side playing the keyboard, and I met these guys, and he said, you know what, man, I think I could show you some chords and some things, and, you know, you could play with us, and I could be out there dancing. So I learned a lot from this guy. You know, he was gracious to show me a lot of the intervals and chords and things that I was dying to learn anyway. So, and then being in that band, did I get some funny looks? Did I get some comments? You bet I did.
And you started playing, I know you told me about that band that you ran when you were 14, but by the time you were 15 or 16, you were playing sessions, right? You were basically a professional musician.
Well, you know, here's the deal. This day and time, as we all know, everybody can be their own record label. Everybody can have their own studio in their bedroom or in a basement or wherever. But in those days, every musician that wanted to be serious wanted to make a record. That was everything. You know, if you could get into a studio and eventually have that 45 or, you know, 33 and a third LP pressed, and look at that label and see either your name or at least know that you're on that record. That was everything. You know, that was everybody's desire. And so I followed that path, and I think I was very fortunate because Muscle Shoals was a mecca of recording. Birmingham had some good studios. Tuscaloosa, not so much. So it was mainly and then, of course, Nashville is not that far away. You know, those were where our eyes turned to try and become successful. And fortunately for me, I was hired to play on a record by an African-American named Freddie North. And this record was called Don't Take Her, She's All I've Got. Played on the original, played Hammond B3 organ on it, and the record went gold, which blew my mind, and probably Freddie North's as well. but you know, that was such an incredible feeling of elation. Wow, man, I'm on this record, and I heard it on the radio. You know, I heard it more than once, and that helped encourage me to want to continue.
I'm wondering what your family thought about you going off and doing all this when you're 14, 15, 16?
Oh, they had concerns. The fact of the matter is I dropped out of high school in my senior year. You know, my grades were not that bad. I was about a B average student, but I was missing so much school because, you know, back then there was a thing called DE, Diversified Education, and it was usually aimed at young men that were, say, in a mechanic, or maybe they had a job in a print shop, or so they would go to school half a day and then get out and go to work. Well, I was a DE student, and I had a position in a recording studio in Alabama my senior year. Well, in addition to recording during the days, we had a band that would go out of town and play mainly fraternity parties, but in part clubs in places like New Orleans, or go to Oxford, Mississippi, or Jackson, Mississippi, or Auburn, Alabama. Or, you know, it was mostly the college circuit that we were doing. And so consequently, we may leave on a Thursday to play a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and I might miss part of Monday or miss Monday altogether. So I was called in midway in the term of school and saying, Chuck, you know, your grades are okay, son, but there's a law in this state that says you have to attend so many days, and you're right on the edge of that. So you got a choice, you know. You can either attend just about every day for the rest of the year, or you're going to have a failing grade or a non-passing grade. So I had to make that decision, and it was not an easy one. And my parents were very concerned, as you can imagine. But they understood my passion and my desire to be a musician, a good musician. And, you know, they didn't applaud the decision, but they didn't stand in my way. And, of course, they preached to me, well, look, if it doesn't work out, come on back. And but for me, it did work out.
And at what point in your career did they relax? Like, was there some point when something happened and they said, yeah, I think Chuck's going to be okay?
Well, the sad thing is that my dad passed when I was 17.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, you know, and we were just at that stage where father and son had become friends, you know, and you could hang together as adults than more so than, you know, a father-son in some disciplinary manner. We were palling up. And it was a quick ending. He died of cancer. Didn't take long. He had lung cancer. He smoked cigarettes like crazy. And I wouldn't say, you know, hugely successful, but I was in a touring band at the time. It was actually Alex Taylor, who was James Taylor's older brother.
Sure.
And there was a record out on the market, and we were playing in pretty good clubs and opening slots for some bands that had big names. But it was sad that he didn't get to see me with the Allman Brothers Band or with the Stones or with Clapton or anybody like that. But my mom did see me have success. As a matter of fact, I have this fantastic picture. We played, it was on the Steel Wheels Tour in 1989. We played Legion Field in Birmingham.
Oh, yeah.
And so sent a car for Mom and her friend and brought them up, and we stayed at the Tutwiler Hotel and got her backstage, of course. And right before we went on stage, we were all dressed up, ready to rock. And I said, hey, guys, would you have a picture with my mom? And I have that. It's a treasure. It's just, you know, she's just holding her little purse and looking up at Mick, and her friend is wide-eyed. And so I was very pleased that Mom got to see something.
Come back, Chuck Lavelle talks about how he creates a piano solo and how the most important tip came from his mom. That and more coming up on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
I want to take just a moment to let you know about a WFAE podcast called FAQ City. The host, Nick Della Canal, takes your questions about Charlotte and goes out to find the answers. He's already solved mysteries from why downtown Charlotte is called Uptown to the fate of the little green cankerworms that used to terrorize our city every spring. It's an entertaining way to learn about this town. You can submit questions to FAQ City through its webpage on WFAE.org. And then you can listen on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever else you enjoy podcasts. Each week on Southbound, we take a moment to highlight our listeners. This week, I want to thank Rachel Sutherland, who said this about our latest episode with Vivian Howard. Rachel says, "So, so good. Excellent reminder about self-awareness and growing into / reclaiming your voice." Thank you, Rachel. And if you enjoy the podcast, we want to hear from you. The best way is to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. When you do that, Apple shows us a little more love. You can also email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org or tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson. Subscribe to Southbound on your favorite podcast provider, and we'll send you new episodes as soon as they come out. Thanks for your support. Now, back to our conversation with Chuck Lavelle. So when you were young and playing in the studio and that sort of thing, were you usually the youngest person in the room? I'm wondering whether other studio musicians or anything like that gave you any grief when you were first starting out.
I was usually the youngest person in the room, and that went on for a long, long time for me. And, you know, more than anything, I got encouragement from my elders, from guys that were, you know, willing to help a young kid out and maybe, you know, try to push him on to the next level. So I was very grateful for that. I learned a lot from a lot of different people, and not just about playing the piano, but the recording process, engineering, you know, the art of working together, the art of listening to everyone as you are playing with them, the art of understanding what a song is asking you to do.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, you know, when I'm hired, especially for a recording session, and you walk in and, okay, so they have a demo or perhaps the artist is just going to play the song on a guitar by himself or herself. And there's a few things that go through my head. One is, okay, the producer is generally there. I want to take in any comments that the producer has. You know, how do you see this record coming about? You know, what's the instrumentation here? You know, what are we emphasizing? What are we de-emphasizing? Same thing with the artist. You know, you want to help the process and help the artist and the producer achieve what they're trying to achieve. Now, that said, you want to contribute. You know, you want to do, I want to play Chuck. You know, I want me in this mix. But the other thing is just what I've said, that you listen to a song, and what does the song want? You know, you think it'll benefit by having a prominent piano part or a prominent organ part, or, you know, are we better off to use a vintage keyboard for this? Is it better for me just to play a pad on the organ and just sweeten it a little bit, or is it better for me to step out and do a solo? You know, what are the lyrics? You know, what is the theme of the song? What is it saying? How can I color that in one way or another? You know, if it's a sad song, how can I play sad? You know, if it's funky and joyous and dance, what can I do to make it jump?
I know you've played on many, many sessions, and if I was to list them all, we wouldn't have any more time left. But I wonder if there's a track that you played on that you still just cannot believe was not a huge hit.
That was not a huge hit. Oh, that's an interesting one. Wow. Ooh, I'd have to go back and really dive into that. You know, nothing just jumps out at me. You know, to be honest with you.
Let me ask the opposite end. Is there a song that you played on that immediately once y'all were done, you knew that was going to make it?
Well, I had high hopes for Greg Allman's first solo record, Laid Back.
Mm-hmm.
And that came almost simultaneously with the recording of the Allman Brothers Band Brothers and Sisters
sure.
record. So, you know, songs like Multicolored Lady that was on the laid-back record of Greg's, I thought that was a really beautiful song. And while it may not have been a hit single, it certainly is a song that people talk about still to this day. Ramblin' Man, I thought, was a hit. I know it was very different for the Allman Brothers Band to do something that was that country, but it just, you know, it was undeniable. You know, it was such a fun little song. And it, you know, it did get flavored by the Allman Brothers Band, you know, especially the ending where Dickey did the multiple guitar tracks.
That little slide part on the way out was just so beautiful.
Yes, exactly. You know, that made it different and unusual and not just a straight little country song. Jessica, I felt, was a really, really strong instrumental, and it got a lot of play, and still to this day I get a lot of comments on that.
Well, I want to stop you there because that's, you know, obviously you know this. People consider it maybe the best piano solo in the history of rock and roll. Certainly, certainly, I know you're laughing because that's hard to hear, I'm sure. But certainly one of the more iconic solos of any kind. And I was reading up about it, and I read something that you had sort of worked out the beginning of it beforehand and then sort of improvised after that. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's essentially right. You know, I wanted it to be an improvised solo, but I wanted a way to start it out that kind of just said, hey, here I am, and that made me comfortable to go from that point. So I worked out that first little part after the, you know, there's a breakdown before the piano solo, a little breakdown with the guitar playing the rhythm and the drums keeping time a little bit, and then the solo kicks off. And so I just had, I would say, the first maybe 8 bars, no more than that. And then it was, hey, let it fly, you know, do what comes naturally. And I guess it worked out all right.
I guess it did, yeah.
You're very kind to say so.
Well, and is that, now are there, did you guys do a lot of takes of that? Are there multiple versions of that solo recorded somewhere?
Probably. You know, we didn't do the song that many takes, as I recall. I wouldn't be able to remember exactly, but my best guess is we didn't do it any more than maybe 5 times. You know, once it felt good, and that was it. So, you know, we didn't beat it to death.
Yeah. And when you played it live, would you always change it up a little bit? Or I've always wondered when there's something, a solo that's so well known, do you feel pressure to sort of play it as it lays, or can you change it up?
Well, I could change it up, but people start looking at me funny. So I've learned to kind of stick with the script these days. I do these days when I do that song, I put a second. I say a second breakdown. It's not really a second breakdown. It's an extended version of the original breakdown, where I just kind of blow on the piano for a little bit before I start the solo, and that makes it a little different.
As a non-musician, I have always been mystified at the solo. It's something that I just have a really hard time understanding, how you can just take off in a piece of music and improvise like that. And I don't know if it's explainable, but if it is, can you sort of explain what you're doing when you do that? Is it a thought process? Is it instinctive? What goes into playing a good solo?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm not sure I can give you a great answer, but for me, it kind of goes back to the song. What is this song about, you know? And so when the solo comes for me, I try to express through my hands and through my mind what that song means. I'll give you an example. When we did the Eric Clapton Unplugged record, and as you know, that was a live record. It was all acoustic instruments.
Sure.
And so we had rehearsed with Eric all the songs he wanted to do, and one of those songs was Old Love. And we went through that rehearsal, and Eric discarded it. He said, I don't know, man, I'm not sure this is really worthy. I don't think it's making it. I was kind of disappointed, but, you know, it's Eric's gig. So we go on, we do the show, and it goes really, really well. People are just excited. The band's excited. We're having a good time. And we played everything that we would rehearsed. And I don't know why Eric turned to me at the very end, but he did. He said, what can we do? They wanted one more song. And I said, Eric, do Old Love. And so he did. We counted it off. And, you know, I was like a coil spring, man. I was ready for that solo. I wanted to, to let my fingers fly, but in a way that reflected what the song is about. And I think that's another one that, you know, if you put a list of things that you're happy with in your work, that would be one of them.
Just go on home.
Say what the song is about. Is it mostly like, I know you talked about reading the lyrics, but do you feel like an emotion or something? Is that what you're looking for, like a melancholy or a happy, or, you know, is that kind of what you're thinking about?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And let me tell you where that comes from. When we go back to talking about, you know, learning the instrument from my mother, one of the things that she did for me, and I have no idea whether this was conscious or just, you know, something that just came out of her, she would say things to me like, well, Chuck, what would it sound like if there was a big storm outside? And so I would rumble down on the low end of the keyboard for thunder, and then I would do some lightning strikes on the upper part. She would say, well, Chuck, you know, how do you think it might sound if you hit a home run with your baseball team? And, you know, what would it sound like if you just had an argument with your best friend? She would say things like that to me. And that has always stayed with me. And so, you know, to be exact in terms of that song, Old Love, you know, you're talking about heartbreak, about, you know, someone that you remember with great fondness, but you had a breakup for one reason or another, and the thought just won't go away. It's there. It's painful. Maybe there's a little joy in there, but it's a tough thing. And so I'm trying to express that feeling.
I got to say, your mama sounds like a pretty good music teacher.
She was a great teacher.
I want to ask one question about Sea Level, which is the band you started kind of, I guess, when the Almonds were sort of on hiatus for a while. I have sort of a very obscure question about it. The song I remember hearing on the radio was That's Your Secret.
Yeah.
And in that song, there is a shout out to Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream, who was my favorite wrestler of all time. And I'm just wondering where in the heck that came from.
Oh, man, how cool was that? The song was written by my dear friend, Randall Bramlett, who I had recruited to come into the band Sea Level, and Davis Causey, who was playing guitar with Randall, and they both came into the band Sea Level. So the story is, you know, like you and so many other of us, we used to tune in and watch a little bit of wrestling on TV, and Dusty certainly was one of the strongest personalities out there. And so literally, Randall's watching Dusty on TV, and Dusty was talking about his opponent and what he was going to do to his opponent. You know, he was going to beat him up. And the phrase, it's going to be agonizing reappraisal for that guy. You know, agonizing reappraisal, you know, that just jumps out, doesn't it? And so Randall took that and put it in the song, and it fit so well.
Do you have any idea if Dusty Rhodes knew, had heard that song, or did you ever hear from him about it?
Absolutely. You know, Dusty used to come to Macon and wrestle at the Coliseum, and our manager at the time, a guy named Willie Perkins, was a wrestling fan, and he knew that Dusty was coming to Macon, and the record was out. And so he said, let's go see Dusty. And we did. We got backstage, and Dusty said, man, I heard that thing on the radio. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. It was fun.
I'm so glad I asked you that question. and I know now you've played a little bit of everything, but I know your latest project, as far as I know, is with a big band, right?
That's right. It's called Chuck Gets Big, and it's with a 17-piece big band from Germany called the Frankfurt Radio Big Band. And they invited me to come do a show with them, and I sent them MP3s of a dozen songs, and they had three different arrangers do arrangements for those songs. And when I got into rehearsal, man, my mind was blown. I mean, they just had the best arrangements. These guys were crackerjack players. They were just at the top of their game. You know, I felt for a minute like I was, you know, in Duke Ellington's band or Count Basie's band or, you know, Ray Charles when he had a big band. It was just such an exciting, amazing, and very different presentation. So we did a concert after one rehearsal, and it just went amazingly well, and it was recorded. And at the time, I already had a record out called Live in Germany, but with a small band, with a five-piece band, and it had some of the same songs, maybe about half the same songs. So I didn't want to, you know, put it out because I already had this Live in Germany record out. And I just sat on the tapes, if you will, for 7 years. And finally this year, I went back. I said, I want to go listen to this again. And I got my engineer, a wonderful engineer, drummer, producer named Jerry Hansen. I said, Jerry, I want to come to your place. Let's put this stuff up and see what happens. Well, first of all, it was so well recorded. The German engineers had isolated everything, really kept the separation strong, and the sounds were crisp and beautiful, and, you know, the players were amazing. I said, well, Jerry, let's see if we can take the audience out of this and make it more like a studio record. And that's what we did, and it turned out amazingly well, and I'm so pleased with it.
I don't want to get done with all this without talking about your sort of second life, I guess, as a tree farmer and environmentalist.
Yep.
Now, you have how many acres out there outside of Macon now working a tree farm?
My wife, Rosalane, and I have about not quite 3,000 acres, 29 and change.
And that was land that, do I remember right, that she inherited, or at least that's where it started?
That's where it started. In 1981, she inherited about 1,000 acres from her grandmother. Her father had passed away not long after she and I were married. And by the way, we've been married 46 years now. So
congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. So when the grandmother passed away, the land that she had went divided mostly between my wife, Rosalane, and her brother. And there was also their aunt was involved, and she also got a parcel of land. I had observed this family. Her family had been tending land for generations. And I had observed this during the times that we were married. We were married in 73, and the grandmother passed away in 81. And so all that time, you know, we'd go out on weekends or holidays, and it just was fantastic to me how passionate they were about the land, how careful they tended the land, whether it was farming or livestock or whether it was tending forest land. And so that ethic began to rub off on me, and all of a sudden we wake up in 81 saying, uh-oh, it's on our shoulders now. You know, it's our responsibility to carry on what we see as a heritage of stewardship of the land. So I went to the library, checked out books. I went to government sources, which were quite good, you know, the NRCS office that helps farmers and whatnot. Got a lot of good information. Eventually, I enrolled in a correspondence course on land use and forestry. And, you know, the reason that we went to forestry, a couple of things. One, the day-to-day required to do row cropping and livestock tending would have interfered with my career as a musician. I wanted to be, you know, feel free to go tour and do what I needed to do. And so forestry being a long-term effort fit that bill. The other thing was the immediate connection of wood to my instrument. You know, where does that thing come from that's given me so much joy, given me a wonderful career? Well, it comes from that resource of wood, as do, you know, most musical instruments.
And I know you've kind of expanded from all this into sort of a wider sense of environmental work. I know you have the Mother Nature Network. Is that right?
Absolutely right, yes. MNN.com, Mother Nature Network. The impetus was my partner, who was is a genius in public relations and advertising and was president of a dominant firm in Atlanta, called me into his office one day and he said, this is back in 2008, and the internet was exploding. Of course, it's still exploding, but it was really, you know, fairly new at the time. And he said, look, I represent Coca-Cola and AT&T and a lot of other very big companies. They've changed their behavior towards the environment. They really want to do things better. They want those messages to get out. I have no problem knowing where to place them in ads of, newspapers or magazines or television or radio. But they're all interested in the internet, as I am, and I can't find a place that I feel comfortable spending their budgets, you know, reaching a large amount of people. What can you tell me, Chuck? I said, well, you're right. You know, I knew most of all the environmental websites that were out at the time, and there was no, if you will, WebMD for the environment. And so my friend Joel turned to me, Joel Babbitt. Joel said, well, what do you think? Is there an opportunity here? He said, I'll tell you what, if I'll resign my position if you'll go in with me, and I think I can get the funding, and let's see if we can do this. And so that's what we did, and we now get 5 to 6 million hits a month. Our offices are in Atlanta. We have probably 20 to 25 eco-journalists that are really, really great at what they do. And the objective is to be the go-to website for environmental news, education, and information.
So tell me a little bit about America's Forests.
Well, yes, this is a new project that we've had going for about a year and a half now. It's called America's Forests with Chuck Lavelle. It's a television program. It has aired on about 40 different PBS stations across the country. I have so much fun with this. I'm very passionate about it. And, you know, Tommy, the thing is there's a million stories to be told about America's forests, whether you're talking about forest products or, you know, clean air, clean water. We did a segment in Denver and partnered with Denver Water to discuss and show how forests clean our water before they get to the stations where they are cleaned further. You know, in other words, we're the first filter. And, you know, there's just a zillion, million, scrillion stories to be told. So there's no shortage of content, and I'm hoping very much to get a full series with America's Forest.
Now, obviously working with the Stones and people like that, you are part of a lifestyle that involves a lot of jet travel and a lot of, you know, buses and 18-wheelers moving equipment from one gig to another, that sort of thing. Have you been able to sort of instill any of those kind of environmental philosophies into that side of the work you do?
To a degree, yes. One of the tours we did in the UK, we worked with a group called Future Forest, and the University of Edinburgh would come in and do a carbon audit. You know, do you have a private plane? Approximately how many people come on average to your shows? How many trucks do you have, et cetera, et cetera? They would do a carbon audit and then offer through this group, Future Forests, the opportunity to offset that carbon. And Future Forests would go out and obtain the trees. Now, you give them the money to do this, of course. And they would go out, get the trees, and get the trees planted. And they did that in Scotland. They did it in Africa and other parts of the world where they could find partners. So the Stones have at least to a degree engaged in that. But when you look at some of the other artists out there, Elton John is a great example. I mean, he always buys carbon offsets to deal with the footprint that he has. Jack Johnson has a totally solar-powered studio. Jackson Brown, Bonnie Raitt are all very active in this regard. And there's a lot of artists. I'm very proud of the musical community and the way that they're dealing with their carbon footprints.
It strikes me that you have this incredible balance where you have this extremely sort of, loud and sort of hectic lifestyle on one end, and this very calming walk through the woods kind of lifestyle on the other. Is that sort of an accurate description of those? And I assume those things are good for each other.
Well, you've pretty much nailed it, Tommy, I'll tell you. There's a quote that I give and a quote that I very much love, and I used it as one of the beginnings of a chapter in one of the books that I wrote. And it's from Robert Louis Stevenson, who said, "In the woods we return to reason and faith." And I think that's so true. You know, after you've gone through a tour and, there's a lot of electricity in the air, you're moving around a lot, you're with an enormous amount of people in large cities for the most part, and you come off of that, and to recharge those batteries and to walk out in amongst my pines and, hear the sound of the wind through the pines and the sound of the songbirds and just general sounds of nature, it offers quite a wonderful balance.
Do you have several pianos at home, and do you sometimes just sit around and play a little bit?
Oh, yeah. I have to stay in shape, and I have two pianos, one at a lodge that we have for guests and one in my house. And where the lodge is the one I use mostly because if we don't have guests, it's very private. And I can just go sit, behind that thing and do technical exercises or just improvise or learn a new song or prepare for a recording session or prepare for a tour. I have to practice. I think athletes have to stay in shape if they're going to play football or tennis or basketball or whatever it might be. And I have to keep myself in shape as well.
And when you say technical exercises, you've been playing piano a long time, but are you still, playing scales and running through chord progressions? And is that kind of stuff you're talking about?
Yeah, definitely. These are things that keep the hands and fingers strong, that stretch them, that allow them to be nimble and to move as you want them to move. And again, it's just like, that tennis player is going to have to do stretches and certain movements and going to have to go in the weight room and do the weight work and do whatever is required to be as good as you can be when you hit that court or when you hit that field.
One more thing, and I'll let you go. You've obviously been doing this a long time. You're this 14-year-old kid or 15-year-old kid just starting out, playing a little bit. Obviously, people think you're pretty good at that time. What did you sort of dream back then that your life was going to be like? And how is it sort of compared to how it's turned out?
Well, that's really an intriguing question. I would say that the desire was to be, as I said to you earlier about that Ray Charles concert, when I walked out of the door of that concert, I wanted to be in a band. I didn't really have a desire to be a solo artist, really. And I'm fortunate to have a solo career in addition to working with other artists. But at the time, the thought was, if I could ever be in a band that had that kind of effect, it doesn't have to be exactly what Ray Charles did, but that is such a strong musical powerhouse that, it would move people. That would be the goal. And, it wasn't about the money. It was about being a good musician and playing with other good musicians and learning from other good musicians. Did I have any inkling of an idea when I was learning songs like The Last Time that I would get to play with the Rolling Stones for 36 years? No, man. I still pinch myself. I've got a dream gig.
Some of you said made me think of one last thing I wanted to ask. You talked about going to that Ray Charles concert and being moved in that way. I'm sure people have told you that your music has moved them, whether it's with the Almonds or the Stones or whatever. Have there been times when you're on stage and you've been able to see it?
there's been so many times when you look out there and you not only see it, but you feel it. There's a vibration that happens. There's an electric current that goes back and forth between the audience and between you and the others on stage. It's indescribable, really, the feeling. But you know it when it happens. And I think more than anything, that's what keeps all of us doing what we do.
Well, Chuck, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you, Tommy. It's been a true joy, man. All the best.
The music you're hearing right now in the background is That's Your Secret by C-Level, one of Chuck Lavelle's many, many musical projects over the years. So what's the secret to a career like his? Well, obviously he's one hell of a piano player, but I don't think that's enough. What came through to me as we talked was his enthusiasm, the joy he still has in getting out on the stage with the Stones or cutting new tracks with a big band. He has that same tone in his voice when he talks about his tree farm or the environmental work he's done over the years. An Eric Clapton song he played on, Old Love. There's a YouTube video of that, and we'll post it on the Southbound episode page. Go take a look. As Lavelle wraps up his piano solo, the rhythm guitar player gives a little nod, and Eric Clapton gives a little smile, and the whole crowd starts cheering. And when the solo's done, Lavelle looks up and leans back on his piano bench for just a minute. It's hard for a man to look happier than he does at that moment. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Delacanal. Our web managers are Jessa O'Connor and Zuri Berry. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and every episode of Southbound on the NPR One app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guests. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.